DG and the team, the department, welcome Honorable Mkunu, our new alternate member. You are welcome to the portfolio committee. We had to move the meeting yesterday to today because we received a request that the minister would like to be part of the meeting. So we did accede to the request and the meeting was moved. We'd like to apologize for any inconvenience, but we did check with the members whether they will be able to attend or whether there are other caucuses other than the ANC caucus, which was cancelled. So we checked with colleagues in the DA. We told there were no caucus. We checked with other members as well. So apologies for any inconvenience. Welcome, Minister. We will then just go straight to the... Okay, maybe let me just first deal with the apologies. The Deputy Minister has been booked off by the doctor. She won't be able to come. Honorable Mabilu is not around, he's in the province. Okay. Honorable Mabika is still sick. Honorable Kekane is attending the funeral of a colleague who she was serving with in the portfolio committee, hotel sanitation. So she's not going to come to attend the tragedy of a member of who passed on. The information I have is that she was knocked off by a car or a truck, but yeah, she passed on following that accident. So should we continue? Any other apology? Okay, Honorable Khadeva is going to join us late. Okay, let's take this opportunity then to welcome and hand over to the minister to introduce the items and tell us who will be giving us the detailed presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. Let's first express our appreciation for the consideration you made to shift this meeting for today. I also like to note that the item that we are discussing was scheduled for some time, not yesterday originally. And yesterday was a cabinet day, Wednesday, where we had a discussion to handle in cabinet. And I may just indicate that that was a major reason why we asked for this, because our portfolio committee was actually, I think, in terms of the program scheduled to be on Wednesday. I do know Tuesdays. I do know that colleagues in cabinet who are allocated Wednesdays do really struggle in straddling between cabinet and these meetings. But I think we've always had an arrangement to, or possibilities to make arrangements between ourselves as members of the cabinet and the portfolio committees, and I would like to say thank you for that. Having said that, I also want to indicate that this is a very important matter, particularly item one, Chair, if the agenda is adopted as is, which is a matter on RDISA, not making other issues unimportant, that is the waste streams and the issues of the Bureau. But I felt that for purpose of discussions on the RDISA, one should actually be present. It is a matter that's in court that I have been signing affidavits for, in case there's any issue that may have to be clarified, at least that I signed for, and I directly saw that I'm here to explain that. Be that as it may, Chair, as it is always necessary, I do not want to dominate the meeting after, and then ask that we get the two people, or the, rather, two aspects of the presentation in one. That is under the RDISA matter. You'd realize that there is a formative stage of RDISA. That is, at the time when it was operating, we have one slide or so to present on that, understanding that I think there has been a very long process to get to that, and if we were to be elaborate on that, it would really just take a lot of long time. But we're just updating on one slide how this was started and when, and then following with the current process and where we are to date as part of the progress report as requested here and as directed that we give. There's also a requirement, and I think I must have missed this, the waste tire plan. It will flow from the current process that we are. So it's really one slide and just also a few slides on the last matter, but the majority, major chunk of this is on this issue. Chair, I must also say that because this is actually going to be a very summarized document, we have brought all the necessary documents that are there, that are background to what we are going to be tabling. So they may be copied, photocopied for honorable members. At your leisure, you may actually read them, because this one line or one page, half a page of this represents the whole file. That's here. Half a page of what we'll be presenting represent half a one file, and there are several of them in here. So I thought that we should also take this opportunity to actually table this for leisure reading, not necessarily now, and for background information for better understanding. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I would now like to ask, although the first slide has something to do with the formative stage, which are to be tabled by Mark Gordon, our DDG, we thought that we shouldn't just disturb the meeting and have one slide and then shift. So Isham would do both from there. DDG Isham Abada. Thank you. Okay, through you, Chair, I think you can. Yeah, I'm
ready. Yeah. Thank you, Minister Isham.
Good morning. Thank you, Minister. Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. This is the background slide that the Minister is referring to. Essentially, RDISA is the Integrated Industry Waste Tire Management Plan that was approved in November 2012. The plan was approved for a period of 5 years, and it was supposed to expire on the 30th of November. That date is incorrect. There are apologies for that, Chair. During 2016, the Department of Environmental Affairs conducted a performance review as part of its midterm review process. Subsequent to that review, or rather during that review process, the department appointed an external service provider to do a performance review on Radisa's progress, and that review actually concluded with some major findings. The major findings were then challenged by Radisa, and the department then asked for a further performance review, or rather that performance review to be externally verified by Ernst & Young. The verified report that was received from Ernst & Young was submitted to the minister, and that report was used as a basis for the court case, which we're going to go into a bit more detail on in the following slides. Okay, I've already mentioned the fact that it was supposed to happen for a period of 5 years. The objective of the Radisa plan was essentially to remediate waste tires and also develop the industries and market for recycled tire products. Radisa appointed a management company that was known as Kusaka Taka, and the purpose of that company was allegedly to handle all operational aspects of the tire plan. One of the principal purposes or objectives of the plan was to ensure that they create employment and also develop small, medium, and micro-sized enterprises, or SMMEs as they better known. The basis for us going to court and requesting the liquidation application was essentially that the department was dissatisfied with the lack of transparency and also inadequate reporting in terms of the plan, and the fact that the department suspected that the targets set out in the plan were not being met. So, as I mentioned, the department appointed iSolvit Consulting as a service provider with an instruction to conduct a performance review of the plan. That review was finalized in February 2017, and then, as I mentioned, subsequently verified by Ernst & Young. The reason for that was the Radisa directors disputed the initial finding. During that process, the department also looked at the information that both iSolvit and Ernst & Young had looked at, and we did our own analysis of that information as well. The conclusions from this performance review and verification indicated something that, obviously, as Minister mentioned, there were quite a few, but we've tried to summarize them as far as possible. So the big issues were governance. So there was clear conflict of interest between Radisa and Kusaka Taka. There was very poor governance controls within Radisa. As I indicated, Radisa failed to meet any of its targets as set out in the plan. There were serious deviations from the approved plan. An example of this is that they were exporting waste tires and that they'd also invested substantial capital amounts in what was called the Product Testing Institute, and that wasn't authorized by the plan initially. Excuse me, Chair. Other issues were misuse of public funds. Some of those included the purchasing by Radisa of immovable property, a substantial amount for that, things like provision of security at the director's private homes, which Radisa paid for, and also other excessive and unwarranted expenditure. Then the other issue was also that there was non-alignment of the Radisa plan to the new regulatory framework. So on the 23rd of May, Radisa made a presentation to the Waste Management Bureau and the department, and they said to the department that Radisa's board had made a decision to place the Radisa's financial year 2018 growth business plan on hold until their funding was until their funding uncertainties were resolved, and that they were going to develop a steady state financial year 2018 business plan and operate against that plan until the 31st of May 2017, and that they would also commence an industry wind down, so that the director's fiduciary responsibilities, as they put it, should could be met should there not be sufficient funding that was allocated to them from June 2017. It also indicated in its presentation that even if they received a cash injection of 210 million rand in July 27, that would only allow them to postpone the wind down to 1 October 2017. They indicated that their cash balance during May 2017 amounted to only 150 million rand. This was a further concern for the department because the Redisa had previously told us that on the 31st of January 2017, their cash balance was actually 426 million rand. So this was a dramatic, inexplicable reduction in their cash balances. So by its own admission, they indicated that it would commence with a wind down of operations, and this was later confirmed by a notice that was sent out to all the Redisa industry participants on the 31st of May 2017. In terms of the actual court applications, after considering, amongst other things, Redisa's presentation and also the reports that were referred to earlier, the minister had to ensure that she acted to ensure that she safeguarded the public funds and the assets that were purchased from those funds. So on the 1st of June 2017, the minister brought an application to provisionally liquidate Redisa. So the order was granted with a return date being the 25th of July 2017, and a provisional liquidator was appointed by the court on the 2nd of June. And this provisional liquidator then took over the business of Redisa as a going concern. On the 8th of June 2017, the minister also brought an application to liquidate Kusaka Taka. Kusaka Taka was the management company I referred to earlier, and that order was granted with a return date of the 25th of July 2017. So Redisa anticipated the return dates in both the above matters, and the matters were subsequently argued early on the 5th and 6th of July 2017. On the 15th of September 2017, the High Court delivered judgment in the minister's applications for the winding up of Redisa and Kusaka Taka and ordered that both Redisa and Kusaka Taka be placed under final liquidation. So during the process, Redisa raised some points in limine, points in law, which were ultimately rejected by the court. So the court confirmed that the minister, in fact, has locus standi, is legal standing, as she was acting in this instance in the public interest, and that the funds that were collected by Redisa were in fact public funds, and the minister had shown cause for bringing the application on an ex parte basis, taking into consideration the secretive manner in which the directors had conducted themselves. The court also found that the minister had shown cause for the applications to be brought on an urgent basis, and there was no evidence presented that the minister had withheld any information from the court, as was alleged by the Redisa director. So in addition to the points in law that the application was opposed by Redisa and Kusaka Taka on the basis that it was not just and equitable for the final liquidation order to be granted, the court rejected Redisa and Katie's argument and found, in fact, that it would be just and equitable to place the Redisa in final liquidation for the following reasons. The reasons were, amongst others, that the manner in which Redisa should be funded was disputed. The minister and Redisa are deadlocked on the issues of a new funding model. The lack of adequate funding and the breach of trust between the parties would lead to a situation ultimately where Redisa would find itself in dire financial difficulties. Redisa, with its existing resources, may not be able to fulfill its obligations in terms of the plan and might become insolvent. And in addition, we mentioned already that Redisa had already started with a suspension of its services as early as the 31st of May 2017. The disappearance of the reserves, which had previously been reported to the minister, and also that there has been an unlawful misappropriation of public funds by the directors of Redisa, which constituted a direct contravention of the Companies Act, as well as Redisa's Memorandum of Incorporation, the MOI that's referred to there. So neither the true nature of the shareholdership of Redisa and Kusaka Taka nor the unlawful payments to the director were disclosed to the minister, and it would therefore be difficult for the minister and the department, as well as the National Treasury, to fund Redisa in future, if such funding, which is public money, would unlawfully accrue to its directors. So this would lead to a situation where no funding would be given to Rhodesia to comply with a plan, which would have dire consequences for the company. Then in terms of the court's view with regard to Kusaka Taka, which is the management company of Rhodesia, the court based its conclusions on the following facts. Kusaka Taka cannot independently exist without Rhodesia, and it's completely dependent on Rhodesia for its funding. So there's no evidence that it will be able to exist without the funding it had received from Rhodesia, which was quite substantial. Kusaka Taka was utilized as a vehicle to misappropriate money in contravention of the Companies Act and also the Rhodesia Memorandum of Incorporation. Then the minister also brought another application to liquidate the Product Testing Institute, a non-profit company. As we indicated earlier, that was also not part of the plan initially. This matter was heard on the 9th of June 2017 in the North Gauteng High Court, and a provisional liquidation order was granted. This particular matter has been allocated special return dates by the Deputy Judge present for the 27th and 28th of November 2017. Next slide. Subsequent to the judgment being granted in court, in both Rhodesia and the Kusaka Taka matters, the executive directors filed notices of an application for leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal against the whole judgment and the order of Mr. Justice Henny, the judge that gave the order in the final liquidation proceeding. Their grounds of appeal are basically that the minister doesn't have locus standi to approach the court for liquidation of private companies, that the minister failed to disclose all relevant information to the court, and that the court erred in finding that the minister had made out a case for the provisional and the final winding up of Rhodesia on a just and equitable basis on the following grounds. That there were mismanagement and or misappropriation of public funds by the directors, justifying the application in the public interest. The fees paid by Rhodesia to the respondent have been misappropriated to Ehrman, Davidson and Kirk, the directors, in contravention of Rhodesia's memorandum of agreement. Rhodesia was used as a vehicle to enrich its directors, and Rhodesia was used in conjunction with Kusaka Taka as a scheme to siphon off public funds for the benefit of its directors or the shareholders of Kusaka Taka. So what are the implications of the application for leave to appeal? So usually in terms of the Superior Courts Act, Section 18, if an appeal is lodged, it ordinarily suspends the operation and execution of a decision, which is the subject of the application for leave to appeal, pending the decision on the application or the appeal. However, in the case of the sequestration orders, which this is, Section 150 sub 3 of the Insolvency Act provides that when an appeal has been noted against the final order of sequestration, the provisions of the Insolvency Act nevertheless apply as if no appeal has been noted. So while the application for leave to appeal has been filed, neither the directors of Rhodesia nor Kusaka Taka have indicated that they regard Rhodesia or Kusaka Taka to be back under their control. So in the event that they attempt to do that, the minister would at that point be at liberty to apply for a declaratory order in terms of Section 150 sub 3 of the Insolvency Act, or in the alternative that the operation and execution of the final liquidation orders not be suspended pending the appeal as contemplated in Section 18.3 of the Superior Courts Act. So in conclusion, the application for leave to appeal, not the actual appeal itself, the application for leave to appeal must be heard by the Western Cape Division of the High Court on the 31st of October 2017. Should that application succeed, the matter will then proceed for hearing to the Supreme Court of Appeal. The directors of Rhodesia might also choose to petition the Supreme Court of Appeal directly should the application not be granted by the High Court. In the interim, the minister has subsequently withdrawn her approval of the Rhodesia Integrated Industry Waste Tire Management Plan with effect from 1 October 2017 as published in Government Notice 1063 on the 29th of September 2017. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much for the presentation. I thought we will get this status quo report as well as an indication as to where to from now, what has been done to deal with the transition from Redisa to what is the new arrangement. I thought we'll also get a presentation that speaks to that. I think if it is there, maybe we can just get that presentation so that we discuss all of them at once. Do we have it?
Chair, we have been asked that as item number 4, we deal with the briefing on the progress regarding establishment of a waste bureau. I guess we could get into that presentation, because in a way it would then provide that transition period. We may just have to speak a bit, elaborate on the actual end of the period. You see the slide, last point on this other slide ends up by saying that let me refresh my mind, that there would be, Minister has subsequently withdrawn the Redisa plan. So it is withdrawn, but there are operators and there were operators on the ground. So the dovetailing would then tell us what we have since done, even as the application for winding down was happening, so that we get to the point of where the waste bureau starts functioning. Because we have, in a way, taken over the plan into the waste bureau, so it is being implemented by waste bureau. So a little bit of detail, whoever presents, would need to be made just to illustrate how dire the situation would have been. May I just start, Chair, by saying that in the presentation we are saying there is information that got to us that Redisa was given notice already that they have about 150 million rand left to operate, which was quite strange indeed. Because this money, remember, that was being collected from the tire industry itself, and it was a lot of money. So that then gave rise to us understanding or having a view that they were going to be closing down. And that closing down would have meant that the number of operators who are on the ground, as in your collectors, your micro operators, everybody who was part of the plan would have been in a very difficult situation. And therefore, that situation would have actually made it difficult for us, all of us here, to say what do we do if people are in that dire situation. The measures that we are discussing, by the way, Chair, I must also say that they are still part of Redisa. That's now going forward. The Redisa application for leave to appeal. If they are granted, their contention, Mark Isham, you'll indicate that, is that they are appealing on everything, even that which was ruled in favor of government. We do think that it is necessary that therefore we become a little sensitive today, even as we're discussing this matter, because of that particular point, because we don't know what the judge is going to be granting them leave to appeal on, in particular if this is actually going to be reviewed or rather rediscussed in court, which we are saying it is not going to be necessary, which is something that we're going to oppose. Be that as it may, I've already just alluded to the fact that there would have been that difficulty in rolling out. And I'm going to ask the DG perhaps yourself just to indicate the process of linking between what work we have done to just bring analysis, spade work of ensuring that there's stability in the system and that there's no one who falls between the cracks. There's no sharp outcry as a plan is now in being discussed in court. So that element is the one that I think we should start with first, even before we talk to the Waste Bureau's functionality and update. Chair, if you allow that, we should do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, just on the REDISA one, the Waste Bureau, the details about the progress on the Waste Bureau, I think, will come. But maybe if we can just focus on this waste tire program. Is it fine?
Yes, we'll try. It's just that they are linked.
Okay. No, yes. Let's see how far we can go. The idea is just to have everything around this so that when we discuss, we don't have to wait for the next presentation.
All right. Thanks, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. As the Minister has outlined, we were going to talk about the transition in Mark's presentation on the Waste Bureau, but I think principally what the Minister said as part of the seamless transition was that in February, as honorable members may appreciate, REDISA was the Minister approved the plan in 2012, so 2 years would have been reasonably then the period of setting up, and then third year, fourth year, that's when we're doing the midterm review. At the same time, because we had already put forward an amendment to the Waste Act that was processed by Parliament in 2014. We then asked REDISA to have that, to comply with those transitional provisions. So in terms of what now is going to link as part of the transition, in February, the Minister invited all the REDISA participants in terms of suppliers, and whether in the form of transporters, micro collectors, processors, to register on the Waste Bureau database. And subsequently, after the ex parte application or the provisional liquidation being awarded in June, then the Minister wrote to the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Public Service and Administration, indicating that we may have to step in as in terms of the transitional process to then implement the tire plan. And basically then we're given the approval through a process of award to then begin to negotiate those contracts. Because legally, we also did not want to remember our liabilities that REDISA has may have incurred. So we had to then cover the legal basis on what contracts the department or the department can then facilitate through the Waste Bureau, and how do we then also open up the process for other people who were not participants at the time. So that is the process that Mark will talk to in terms of what we've done. So administratively, there is going to be a seamless transition, and basically from the 1st of October, we have then began to get those approvals and sign up some of those operators. So that is covered in the presentation. And then secondly, we also had, the Minister had invited calls for tire plans previously, and that process is also it is also covered in the presentation. So we have a dual approach wherein we have a transition to make sure that, one, we don't end up with people who say they were working in the sector having been impacted negatively, and therefore, even without sufficient merit, some of them possibly did not meet all the requirements, but for purposes of stability and consistency, we then were allowed to sign contracts to between 3 months and a year with the approval from National Treasury. So in that period, we are also then looking at the process that was initiated in terms of Section 28 of the legislation. So that is in a nutshell what I think in responding to the question raised by the Chair would be the response. Thanks, Honourable Members.
Okay. Mark? Are you coming in? I see that the first three slides talk to Redisa. Maybe we must just get those slides on the presentation. On the Waste Management Bureau, I guess let's just get those and then so that to facilitate the discussion. Who's going to take us through those slides?
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Chair, Minister, Honourable Members. Thank you. So Chair, in terms of the presentation on the Waste Bureau, as DG has aptly described, that the Bureau had to step in terms of plugging in the interim aspects surrounding stabilizing the existing plan. And in terms of the regulations, the Bureau is empowered to do that. And in terms of the 2017 Waste Tire regulations, they provide for the transitional arrangements in the event that a Waste Tire Management Plan expires, is withdrawn, or is terminated at the time there exists no other Waste Management Plan in terms of Section 28 and 29 of the Waste Act. So in terms of that, the functions of the Waste Bureau then is to supervise and control the management of the waste tires for that interim period until the new industry waste tire plan is approved, also in terms of the same sections of the Act. So in the next presentation, we'll also give you an idea of the time frames relating to the Section 28 plans. And to say that they have been advertised, the next plan for Waste Tires, and we are in the process of publishing the notifications requiring the new plans to be approved. Next slide. So, Chair, in terms of the updates on the Waste Bureau, there is a NEMLA, the National Environmental Management Laws Amendment Bill, which was tabled on the 24th of May this year, which provides for some amendments that's required for the establishment of the Bureau, and also certain amendments relating to the board's establishment of the board, powers, governance structures, and some oversight aspects relating to the operations of the Bureau. To date, that bill has not been passed yet, so it's important that that happens soon. And in the interim, the DEA has, the department has obtained approval from the Department of Public Service Administration to commence with the filling of posts, and I'll go through that in detail shortly. That will be in addition to the DEA establishment until such time that the entity is fully established. Treasury also provided approval for the Bureau to enter into contractual agreements with the plan participants, and I'll go through that in detail as well, and for those transporters, depot managers, and operations contractors that's been registered with the Bureau. Lastly, the Treasury also indicated the readiness and willingness to list the Bureau as a Schedule 3A public entity, and that process is underway. And in terms of the bill, it requires that that bill be passed in order for that to happen conclusively.
Chair, I'll then take you through some of the questions relating to the logistics and the operations that the Bureau had to get involved in very quickly during this interim period. And that relates to the full value chain of how a waste tire plant operates in the country. It relates to the collections, transportation, storage in depots, micro-collections, and processing of waste tires. In terms of the waste tire regulations that was passed on the 29th of September this year for implementation on the 1st of October, the Waste Bureau then undertook full operations on the 1st of October. At that time, we tried to give you by Friday last week, Chair, a kind of summary in terms of what these types of operations entail. And it's quite detailed across the country. There's a network of transporters, collectors, depot managers, processing capacity across the country. We tried to give you a sense of where we were last week. In terms of that, secondary transporters were fully operational, all of them by the end of last week. So too were about 46 transporters. A lot of them, Chair, were also been asked to submit their more detailed contracts, and the Bureau was furiously busy with signing them all up, and contracts were approved, and we are of the opinion that the operations are fully maintained, and we have a handle of what's happening there across the country in terms of the collection and transportation of the waste tires. The next slide talks to the how we're managing the depots across the country, and these are where the tires are, once they're collected, they are stored there before being transported and distributed to various processing facilities across the country. And by last week, Friday, we had about 68% of the transporters collecting and sending to depots. And we give you an idea there of the tonnages that were delivered across KZN, Western Cape, and Gauteng. And by today, obviously, that capacity has increased much more to be beyond 80%, I would assume. And we really have a firm handle on what's happening in terms of the management of the waste tires currently. Chair, I'll go in next into the structure of the Waste Bureau. We have presented... Thank you.
Yeah, I can no, I can proceed. Yeah.
Thank you.
Just thanks, do the whole thing.
Chair, we have presented this previously, but it gives you a kind of snapshot of what the organogram of the Waste Bureau looks like, and I'll take you through some of the detail of where we are in terms of the recruitment process for those positions. They relate to the top executive management together with senior management that would be assumed to take up the positions first before we fully operationalize the Bureau. The next slide speaks to the posts that were advertised with the closing date of the 11th of September. They relate mainly to senior executive positions relating to extended producer responsibility positions. These are mainly the industry management positions that would oversee the various industry plans. They also speak to some of the specialists that would be needed in these operations that I described, transportation, logistics, processing capacity, regional coordinators, project management, specialists in IT, and so forth. We also, Chair, advertised the executive positions. They had a closing date, next slide, of the 15th of September. And they relate to the top echelon of the structure in the Bureau, CEO, CFO, COO, and the heads of the various units for knowledge management, business development, risk, legal, finance, supply chain management, and so forth. Chair, in terms of the last slide on the progress on the recruitment, a number of interviews have already been concluded in this month. We currently busy at fast-tracking the rest of the interviews, and they would be handled Thank you very much, Chair. Yeah, I mean, all of the interviews have not been concluded. We are busy with finalizing the recruitment process. Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for the presentation. That's the report, honorable members, on RDISA. So RDISA, as we know, it is been wind down. So very soon it would not exist, depending on the court, the appeal. So the matter will still have to be finalized in the Supreme Court of Appeal. If they are granted that application for leave to appeal. Questions, comments? Okay, Minister.
On one of the slides, we are indicating that the plan has actually been withdrawn.
Yeah.
So even if a RDISA does exist, it'll be infrastructure that is now being handled by this thing. So the entire plan as allocated to RDISA is no longer there. It was coming to an end anyway, at the end of November. And we had given notice to that effect and have said so as well. Thanks.
Okay. Comments? Questions? Honorable Edwards? Payden? Makubel? Yeah.
Thank you, Jay. Okay, just bear with me because I've got a couple of. I want to go back to slides, etc. So, okay, first of all, I want to ask. When you read everything in the newspapers and you've watched Carte Blanche and you read the presentations and the stuff that's on the on DIA's website, there's a couple of things that are still unclear for me. First of all, I want to know the Kusaga Taka, I don't know how you say that, if you say tch or g or whatever.
Kusaga Taka.
That one. Okay, there we go, thank you. Okay, so basically it's like a sub-company that they established. What I don't understand is that how does a company, or let's say it's a company, get the plan for the tires? How do they get away with appointing a company to do what they're supposed to do? RDISA is supposed to manage the tires. The plan was, okay, et cetera, et cetera, there's SMMEs, but the basic is to manage this. Then they go and they create Kusaga Taka, which in turn manages RDISA with directors like Stacey, Herman, all of them are on the same. You know, they reduce the directors, they're on the board, they're on this one as well. What I would like to ask is that whether DIA was aware of this, you know, that they've got the same directors, etc. Okay, and then also, did this decision go through DIA? Because as far as I know, it wasn't part of the original plan, these extra companies, entities, whatever. Did this decision go through the department? And then also, why did it take so long to pick up what we've picked up last year? Did RDISA did they report to the DEA often? How often? Annually? Biannually? I know it was a 5-year plan, but surely there needed to be targets, you know, set plans, set annual plans, et cetera, et cetera. Then when we go to the slides, I want to, which slide is this? Slide number 5. Performance, Redisa failed to meet any of its targets. So did the department, did they do annual audits? I mean, we scrutinize our entities in, you know, to the core, but these guys were given a plan with billions and billions of rands. So did we do that? Did we scrutinize them or as the department? And it says that they failed to meet their targets. So this was started in 2016, that it's talking about. Does it mean that they reached their targets in previous years? Slide number 15. It says that number 3, Redisa was used as a vehicle to enrich its directors. Now, when I said with my last budget speech, I said it was the failure of the department to monitor Redisa, which ensured that Redisa could manage a little bit too much into their own pockets. I was hit over the knuckles. So I just want to know.
Yeah, over the knuckles.
I was hit over the knuckles. I was said naughty, you know, like, you can't say that. So what I want to know is that with this point, taken into consideration, they didn't enrich themselves in 2016. They didn't enrich themselves in 2015. They did it from 2012 onwards. So I want to know, how did the department miss that? If Carte Blanche can pick it up, if whoever can pick it up, why didn't we start putting it out there before? And then lastly, Chair, I would like to know which body within the department was responsible to monitor Redisa or the tire plan. Surely there must be someone that could be held responsible. And also, how did the monitoring tool work? How did we monitor the plan? I think I'll leave it there for now.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Paddy.
Thank you, Chair. If someone just can clarify, if the monies, the levies that were being collected, and I'm open to correction, I think it was 2.30 rand, is that money still being collected? And if yes, where it is it being directed to? Where is it being held? Is it by the Waste Bureau, or where is it being held? So that's it. Firstly, clarity on that, and then the way I understand it is 2.30 rand per kg plus VAT. Now, I haven't seen anything about VAT. Are there VAT issues in this? In this debacle or not? Because I mean, that would be quite substantial as well.
Okay, Honourable Makobel.
thanks, sir. I thought Honourable Pardon will still take time. I know him to have a lot of questions. So
clarified.
Oh, okay. Chair, just a few issues for my clarity, or probably all of us. I think from where I'm seated, firstly, is just to appreciate the fact that ultimately, if it was a scam which people were utilizing to squander the monies and so on and so on, that was finally exposed or found out, and it's being dealt with. But just to check whether if Redisa is insolvent, it means it should be liquidated, it can't exist as a company. If it's not, even if the department will still fight it and so on, it means it can still be able to participate in future under the West Bureau as a particular company. I'm just checking whether it's sort of blacklisted. It cannot necessarily operate in this particular fashion. The second point, there's talk of disappearance of resources or allegation of the resources having disappeared after the talk of some 400 and something million rands, and the next thing is 150 million rands. Is there plans or means to recover these resources? But perhaps I should have started by checking whether the department can say with certainty that money has disappeared, and therefore either money or whatever resources has disappeared and therefore should be recovered, because I don't think it's a matter that can just be left like that. If indeed we show that there's been disappearance of resources, and we can talk to that. The third point, if I am on my third point, Chair, is these small operators, or all the operators under REDISA, were they somewhat, or was there any analysis done to them with regard to their viability? Or simply because they were under the flight of REDISA, they were registered automatically. All that was done was to just request plans from the, or whatever requirements were done, just to ensure that they are registered, even if they are not viable. Or it's work that must still be done, you know, in the event, just to ensure that we don't just proceed with people or companies. Small as they are, they may be, I'm not saying that there may be a justifiable cause why they should exist, but it's another to ensure that they actually are viable, so that later they are not found to be in serious challenges themselves. The last point, Chair. The West Bureau now is not fully fleshed as in terms of the directors. I take it the board is in place, or not as, or the board is not even there. The executive, in terms of the administrators, are not there. So it means all this work now, the transition that we're talking about, and so on to ensure operators are there, is done by the department as we speak.
We want the answer immediately.
No, okay. I think okay. I need clarity. If that could be spelled out, that
okay.
REDISA is in this crisis winding down and cannot be given the authority to do anything in terms of going forward, even the plans are withdrawn. The board and all of that, the department will process that, I understand. But this transition that we're talking about, ensuring that operators are registered, plans are required from them to ensure that part of this thing going forward are not affected by the plight of this. Who's exactly running it? That's what that I'm trying to change. Okay, thanks.
Okay. So the questions. Any further question? Gone. So those are the questions. but I think the most fundamental of all the questions is the governance and accountability mechanisms between REDISA and the department at the point of approval of the plan. what system did we put in place to ensure that on a regular basis we monitor the performance of Rhodesia. The plan was to expire at the end of this month. It was reaching its natural lifespan of 5 years, November this year. Yeah, November next month. So it's almost towards the end that the department is now putting a stop to that, which is wrong that was done. It goes back to the first question, whether what mechanisms were there, whether we were applying them, were we requesting reports, what were we doing with those reports. And my question, I think, would be, has the department received a report from the liquidator? Interim report, because I think the purpose of liquidating was to stop the directors of both Rhodesia and KusaSataka from further accessing their accounts. So have we received a report in terms of whether there was any funds in the accounts of particularly KusaSataka? What is the interim report telling the department? And the Waste Bureau, I'm a little bit uncertain as to where are we with regard to the legal standing of the Waste Bureau. The presentation says we need to finalize the bill, which is something that I think we must give priority to. But as we are sitting here today, what is the legal standing of the Bureau? Is it a legal entity on its own? How does it operate, or is it still under the department for now? It has not been fully established as a Schedule 3B entity. And what capacity is there? Because the report is saying there is an advertisement for positions. But currently, what is there? Because even the interviews have been conducted now for the CEO and senior management and other positions. But who's currently the Waste Bureau? Do we have people there? What is the arrangement? And so forth. So those would be my questions. Now, there is 210 million that was spoken to here. I suppose that is the allocation that Treasury has made to the department. Can we get an indication whether that is sufficient to implement, particularly as the Rhodesia program? My understanding is that the 210 is not only for this, for the waste tire, it is also for the establishment of the Bureau itself and its operation. So the question is whether is that sufficient, or is there a need to further relook into that. Okay? Those are the questions, Minister.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I am going to touch on some few questions and ask the DG and Mark and Isham to some extent also to respond to some. The fundamental question, I think, here is what around what you have asked here and the Honourable Member Edward about the issue of accountability and whether there were mechanisms set put in place. Let me start by saying that we need to understand first the structure of what this register is. And may I also just digress a bit right at the onset, that right at the beginning, that even as we say RDISA will probably exist even if the court rules otherwise in their favor, the reality of the matter is that here we are talking about a quasi-company or a company that has been doing work on behalf of government. And that part has actually been declared by court, even as they were saying there's no locus standi and so forth. All those things will be argued, obviously. So because this is, has been a kind of a quasi thing, by the way, remember it's the first of its kind. Even the liquidation that we have applied for is first ever in the country under the Companies Act that it has actually happened. So we have several firsts that we are learning from. No company has been applied for by ex parte like we did. And even in terms of existence of such a company that does work or a quasi-state entity or whatever, quasi, hasn't existed anywhere else. So it was in terms of this plan. So several lessons had to be learned as we moved on. We have already indicated that the first year this company was, or this entity, or let me just call it RDISA, was setting up. That's the first year. How did it run? In terms of the structure, they had to have a board. A board that helps manage this particular entity. And they did have a board. So that then removes the day-to-day running or management or day-to-day oversight by a particular manager or whoever in the department, because there's a board. The board then accounts directly. But this is a board that then was supposed to have had a closeness to government, and it didn't have that closeness to government. So what the board decisions were, we were not privy to those decisions. And I thought that honorable members would say a big praises to this department that we have found out this particular mess even before the end of the financial year, of the end of the plan. I thought that that's what we were going to be told, because it's certainly not carte blanche that revealed this thing. It is not. I'm saying this with confidence here. It is us who actually uncovered what has been happening. Quietly, we did this oversight. Quietly, we have been digging and digging until such time that there was time now to actually begin talking about it. Quietly, I'm saying we've been digging. And the reality of the matter is that we should say this. A company that, or a RDISA that's no longer functional, even if they get out of this present court period, with a decision by court that says a liquidation, final liquidation is not granted, or rather it's ruled in your favor. They do know that there's no plan to operate, and yet they are still going to court. That's indicative of the fact of the kind of company that we're talking about, or a group of people that we're talking about. There's never been a moment of no fight, right from the onset, on anything. Chair, you were called in your capacity as chairperson of this portfolio committee to another meeting of the portfolio committee on finance. where we were actually discussing the issues of which I'm going to touch on, that Honourable Member asked about where the money is. Where we're discussing the money bill that now requires us to collect these levies, no longer directly by Redisa, no longer directly by any other company, but by the state. We ourselves actually put that proposal to Treasury, and it was accepted. It took a long time in consultation during this period. And I'm saying, because we had discovered these problems quite ahead of time, we're quietly dealing with them, including putting, ensuring that there's that money bill of collection of funds. In that meeting, Chair, we were quite aware that you actually found Redisa there. They knew that that meeting was going to be discussed, and they went there also to put up a fight against the collection by government. So there's never been a moment of no fight. We have been saying to Redisa, we want a report like now, this financial year, first, second financial year. This company would say, I wish they were here. No, this is not a court, so we'll meet in court. They would say, what kind of a report are you looking for? Someday they would even go to an extent of saying, please show us how to do this business plan. A company that's registered or people who are business people, show us how to do this business plan, meaning that give us a pro forma, draft this thing for us. Deliberately delaying tactics all the time because there's always been this fighting mood. We had to go through the procedures, Honourable Members, because even as we probably could be accused that we took time, we had to ensure that whatever we do as government, we leave no stone unturned, we leave no loophole which could actually make this company stand and having anything that stands against us. So that's the reason why the processes were going as they were. Not that we didn't uncover, we actually had uncovered, but we also didn't want to make noise about it. We had to put in, as we say here, you can see, the I Solve It report, first part of it, that first report, it was difficult even in getting inputs from Redisa. Extremely difficult. I Solve It report finalized. We saw the quality of report, which was, but we needed to do verification because we needed facts, and actual facts that can help us stand the test of time. So the board has always been there, but it's obvious it's a board in their favor. And that's one thing that we actually learned in this process, that even as we are going to be putting boards of other structures in the future, we have to ensure that this is a structure that can actually account as a board direct to government on a continuous basis. And that doesn't mean, therefore, that we didn't do that work, but it was just not willing to come on board with the required processes. And I think Mark can then talk to the detail about how this process of accounting was put in place and at what stage did we call on for reports and they didn't come. I am witness to that, I know. As a matter of fact, because I've had to, even at the highest level, write letters to them to say, I'm now putting you on temps. If you have not been able to respond to our managers, I'm putting you on temps. On several occasions, I've actually had to do that. I mean, not even several occasions. I actually even physically met them, by the way, to say, you are supposed to bring this report, and especially the business plan. So, that is it really about how accounting was going. 2.5 years down the line, or even 2 years down the line, that report was done. We have uncovered what we have uncovered. We do think that we are continuing to uncover what we uncovered, more of it. Product testing was set up even without our knowledge, completely not discussed with government, but we then picked this up. That's why we even went for product testing. There's argument that product testing is their company. Maybe we shouldn't talk too loud about it and too much about it, because product testing is still appearing in court in November this year. There were, by the way, suggestions by Redisa that, again, another delaying tactic, let's postpone product testing's hearing and subject that to the process post their appeal on liquidation. We do think that it is not necessary, and we've sent that instruction through our senior counsel and junior counsel that they wanted this date. We are not having any further delay, and that case, in our view, must sit in November, because we see another delay of having money somewhere or even this product testing still going on. By the way, let's also say that we also get to discover that product testing is not set up only for tire, waste tire. They are trying to use it for all other waste streams, meaning that it's a company that sees itself broadening itself into other spaces where it's not been allocated work to do. 2.30 rand, I think, is being collected. We have already indicated that it's now being collected through Treasury. That bill, we were the happiest. By the way, let me also say there's been quite a lot of, shall I put it as lobbying, Chair? A lot of lobbying that says, please don't go that route of Treasury collecting that money. We refused. We are still refusing. This 2.30 rand levy or whatever it is, any form of levy is going to be collected by Treasury through SARS, and then the reallocation gets done together with the rest of the money, which will be accounted for through normal processes of government through Treasury. Not even us. The amount of money, Chair, that is 210 million rand, is already part of that. So Treasury will keep allocating to us what we need to use for a particular plan, as per the business plans, by the way. Which, when we were saying produce a business plan for us to run, they were not willing to produce that business plan. So I think somebody will talk about the issues of VAT right now. Just issues raised by Honorable Makubela. If this was a scam, could this company be liquidated? We will say it on record, off record, we have applied for its liquidation. That's very clear to date. If a liquidation doesn't stand, we will follow through other means of getting our money. In fact, not we will. We've already begun doing so. It's just that some of the processes were too slow for us, because we still believe that even the last of a cent spent from government irregularly or erroneously or wrongly must be uncovered and recovered, whatever money is we're talking about here. So yes, liquidation, and we do hope that indeed our application becomes successful so that there is no comeback. By the way, let's also remember that if it does, indeed we have that liberty and latitude to actually blacklist, and through Treasury we can ask that that gets done so that there's no future comeback of any other way. And I think thanks for raising that matter, because there might be a loophole there. But be that as it may, we don't see how that can actually happen. The security forces, as I say, are following through money that we at some stage even were informed that there were money offshore. Is there still offshore? We are searching there. Just to indicate that indeed, Chair, one of the questions that you asked is whether there was a funds, what did you say? I'm sorry, I lost that point, but I'll come back to it.
Whether there is any interim report from the liquidator.
Okay.
Is there anything that has been discovered?
I think DG will talk about even the details about what has been found on the bank accounts, on everything else. I'll leave that question for her. But I just wanted to talk about this issue of maybe before I conclude, Chair, the Waste Bureau has got two components. We had to do the administrative part of it, which is about staffing and all that goes with it. And the authority on staffing that gives authorization and all is Minister of DPSA. So once you have a structure, the Minister of responsible for this department, like me, issues or authorizes a structure as it was authorized. And then I concur, get it to concur, Minister of DPSA to concur with the structure. The Minister of DPSA has concurred with the structure, and that is the reason why we are filling in that structure. The shape of that structure, DG will also talk to that, of the entity, it's going to be Schedule 3. It can only become a fully fledged Schedule 3 with a full board once honorable members in this August meeting have actually passed that bill. I'm trying to plead with the meeting that indeed, as you said, Chair, it is necessary that the bill gets at least fast-tracked, because that's what's going to allow us to appoint the board. That's what's going to allow us to actually get this entity full functional. If we have already done the spade work, so Treasury is waiting for this bill so that we set up that entity formally, and it actually is declared by Treasury as a Schedule 3. For now, it's in the it's waiting for the legislation. It's in the, every work has been done, staff is being appointed, Treasury has been negotiated with on the Schedule 3, they are waiting to authorize, and they are waiting for this particular bill to become an act, which is under now under NEMLA. So I think, DG, you can touch on some of these things. I may come back if there's any need for us to fill in anywhere else. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister, and honorable members. I'll quickly touch on some of the responses that the Minister has asked us to fill in on. And I'm going to also allow Mark and Isham to come back later. Just quickly on the Minister has answered broadly the question around accountability, that the board was accountable. Then the next part of the question was how we were monitoring as a department. The RDISA, firstly, in the first 2 years, we take it that they were setting up, and we only received financial statements from 2015 from RDISA. And they were also reporting to the department monthly. Okay. So those monthly reports, as Minister was indicating, that they were giving the department a runaround, they were not detailed, and both on governance and financial reporting, and also on the other performance objectives. So the branch, in the form of DDG Mark, has been meeting with them, and even the acting DDG that was there previously before Mark took over the position. They have been receiving those reports, and they had meetings with them. And every time those reports were not adequate. Secondly, the memorandum of incorporation outlined all of the provisions, both of the directors or the board, as well as the setting up of a management company. So that is allowed for, but the question is, how did they go about doing it, is what was not compliant. So the department has been asking for even the agreement between RDISA and Kusaka Taka. We've been asking in our records. That is one document that we've never been able to receive from RDISA until the liquidation, provisional liquidation. We have never seen that. In my meeting, I had a meeting with the RDISA executives, with my department's executive, to get some of these governance issues. And we explained to them, like we do with all our public entities, what is required, how it can be done, and how the department can assist them to come into compliance. Okay. So, but we then said, give us these documents. If there are gaps in these documents, we would then help you to sort those gaps out. Because it was not, for us, it was never really about being vindictive or against what, because we thought that the plan was a plan that could really deliver the outcomes that the department was looking for. So we had trust, and we also put a lot of that trust with us not seeing the actual documents. We had no way of knowing that the directors were also in the same directors. Were in KT and so on and so on. We did not have that information. That is a real fact. So our response therefore is that since then we received the financials in 2015, the full extent of the structure and the disclosures have also never really been that clear. They never came to light until the liquidation. But in the letters, the letter that I wrote in myself in August, we gave them 30 days, they requested an extension. After that they told me, I don't have powers. It's the minister that has approved their plan. The minister wrote letters, even last year, October. Instead of them responding to that, they then went to court in December to even question the minister's power to even consider suspending the plan. So that is the situation, and therefore, in reality, I think we can say that without fear of any contradiction, that the department was aware that there were certain irregularities, but we could not really provide the evidence fully for them, because documentation, even the auditors, when they went to their facilities for the meetings, they would still not be given all the information, let alone even going into the system. We had experts that could go through the systems. They were not allowed that. And the principle was then that they were standing on was that they were not a government entity. The extent of the compliance with Treasury regulations or PFMA was non-existent in their view. So those were their points of contention since. So whatever we required in terms of what we understand as compliance was then not forthcoming. Then I think one other part, in respect, again, RDISA is being a non-profit organization. In terms of SARS, it is classified as a public benefit organization, okay? And therefore it was exempt from paying some of the taxes. So, however, SARS is dealing with the issues around ownership and exactly what they have accounted for, what they've been paying and not paying. So we have given SARS, because they are another organ of state, to then look at the level of compliance in terms of the tax legislation. Similarly, with the Department of Trade and Industry, because we've worked with all of these departments. They are then following through on all the company law transgressions as well as BEE transgressions, because again on BEE they've had companies, when we met with them around the SMMEs and whether they are registered, they have seemingly had a practice of fronting, because all of those companies that they said were black owned were in actual fact having the same directors of RDISA as directors of those enterprises. So those are some of the transgressions that they have to then be investigated by another organ of state, which is the BEE Council. Then, honourable members, before I hand over to Mark, I was supposed to just outline how much money. When the provisional liquidators were appointed to take control of both RDISA and KTC, they were able, Honourable Chair, to locate and freeze funds in all the bank accounts with an approximate value of about 180 million. Okay, and some of the monies that we see in the other, we thought were in the other banks, they could not access legally, because those companies, as much as we've listed them in the findings, those are still private companies, and we needed to then have separate applications for all of them. Similarly, that's why the minister was talking about the Product Testing Institute and the others. We wanted to do some of those other companies in Pretoria, 9 years, and the others. All of those we know they have, there are funds, we can see from the financials that funds move from the registered KT to those banks, but we can't legally freeze those accounts because we have not been given the court, the power by the courts to actually access. So we pray that those monies are still there, but if they are not there, maybe then there will be another recourse in that respect. So, and there was also an undisclosed remuneration of about 152 million that was paid by Redisa to the executive directors through KTC. So the directors themselves, there are figures, as I indicated now, that indicate that they've earned more than what was in their initial agreements, because partly we also, one of the requests that we had was contracts of the executives. How much are they earning? We were not getting that. We got that now through the process of liquidation. And some of them, they
so
are
the one, is it 150?
152 million just for the directors.
For one financial year?
Yes, in one financial year. Over the period? Okay, over the period.
Over the period.
Yes. But we can just outline the period. I'll ask Hanley to come in to confirm the period. And then on the other waste streams, they've spent, I mean,
so
the product.
If it's over 5 years, it means that director was earning how much per annum?
Okay.
Over 30 million.
Yeah. They moved, there was an amount that she he had, there was an amount that he had a salary, and then how it increased. So those are, that's the information. We could not get that. We would not be able to act on those before because we did not have those records. That is what I think the essence of what Minister was outlining as the challenges that we had before. So the department was not sitting. We had reporting measures, but we were getting insufficient information to be able to make. And then lastly, then I thought I would comment on this one and hand over to you, Mark and Isha. Okay. Then, let me just quickly say the bureau is a legal entity, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. That's established in terms of the Waste Act, and it's a legal entity that operates under the department. So, in the absence of the bill that we, the finalisation of the amendment bill, then the bureau, the department, the minister's executing authority, the DG as the accounting officer also takes accounting responsibility for the bureau until we have a board after the legislation has been. And therefore the listing is awaiting that element with Treasurer. And the extent of this work is just generally not quite, it's not prudent for the department to have these two roles. Preferably, we need the legislation to then enable the listing so that it's a separate entity that accounts.
Okay, just on that one, DG. So now legally, the employees who are being appointed are appointed by
that, yes.
Under the bureau.
Yes,
under public service
regulation. Yes.
Okay.
So can I come to that then quickly, Chair? So two things. The monies, the levies are being collected from February, 1st of February by SARS, based on the money bill that was passed by Parliament. Secondly, we have the Bureau operating under the department. Okay. And all of these officials that have got other work are doing the work of the Bureau. Currently, we have only 3-4 resources that we have contracted in the form of Nolwazi, who was here the last time, and also Ms. Mamusa Africa, and 2 other resources that are contracted. So currently, they don't have certain powers. I sign, the DDG has certain responsibilities. The COO has certain responsibilities that are delegated, and the COO team is here that is doing the work of the Bureau every day today until we. The number, it's the total staff members of the department. So it's the CFO, because the CFO, all the supply chain people, the SIGWAD's chief directorate is working on the administration of the contracts. All the finance people will be dealing with the payments. The legal people, Isham's people, were doing the contracts and vetting the contracts. Mark's people were looking at some of the logistics around exactly how those would work. And we are then analyzing. So we have three people that are more full-time, but all of these people are doing the work. The governance team is then looking at all the governance measures. Both Anthony and Hanley are doing the work. So it's the work.
Maybe we should have asked
and
for introduction.
And myself, I'm doing two DG jobs.
Because I see there's new faces.
Okay.
We normally ask for introductions, but I think after you are done,
all right,
you can then ask them to introduce.
Okay. So currently, Chair, then the answer is that we have three contracted capacity, but the rest of the capacity of the Bureau is the department capacity. So I have to separate my role as DG. One hour I do the work of the Bureau, and in another hour I'm the DG. So I have to have those approvals. That's why we wrote to Treasurer, so that we clear how am I making approvals that relate to the work of the Bureau versus where I am then responsible for the work of the department oversighting the Bureau. So I'm playing two roles, and the minister is playing three roles at the same time. So she's also a regulator, and so that is the current situation in terms of the setup on the capacity of it. So I just want to hand over to you, Mark, and then Isham.
Okay, before Mark, can we get introductions? Mark has introduced himself before. So the gentleman next to him.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Anthony Pillay. I'm from the Internal Audit Directorate with Undergovernance at the Department of Environmental Affairs.
Mamohala Mosekene, under the branch Chemicals Waste, responsible for Integrated Waste Management as Chief Director.
Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Hanli Skuman. I'm the Chief Director for Governance in the Department.
Morning, Womba Gaziplo. I'm responsible for administration and coordination within the branch Chemicals and Waste Management.
Good morning, I'm Gauta Mokoena, Chief Director of Chemicals and Waste Policy Monitoring and Evaluation.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark.
Thanks, Chair. I just wanted to also add on to what DG was saying in terms of Honourable Edwards' question relating to the monitoring controls and management and so forth. And I think it's safe to say that in terms of when RDISA began full operations, it was only about 2 years later from 2013. The major part of 2013 going into first part of 2014 was subject to another court challenge that RDISA faced, and in fact they only started started operations in about June 2013. The major part of that period, going into 2014, much of 2014, was really setting up a massive network across the country. And given some idea of what that value chain and logistics is in terms of my previous presentation, RDISA took a long time to get that infrastructure set up, network and system going. The first annual report, full financials, were only received in late 2015, when we began to get an idea of the full extent of the financial operations and so forth. That was done by KPMG, and at the time KPMG gave them a clean audit, and full financials. Then we've only received two. In fact, in terms
why
of
why is the whip giggling? You know something we don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair, I wouldn't go into that myself right now. But so Chair, what I'm alluding to then is in terms of the cooperation. DG went into some extent there, but You know, I must state categorically that RDISA delayed in giving us information. They obfuscated. They did not cooperate. They withheld crucial information. We have, in terms of the court documents that support to give supporting evidence in terms of correspondence, written minutes of meetings, letters from myself, from my staff, from the minister, from the DG, numerous correspondence to RDISA, obliging them to report on certain matters. Reports were vague. Often, when we asked for more detailed information, it never came. It took, in fact, years to come. We have given in our correspondence instructions whether to do certain things. We gave instructions in terms of their mandate and their limitations, what they could do and what they could not do, and that we have on record. The midterm review, in fact, commenced, our investigations commenced in late 2015. It was before the carte blanche expose that we did a full compliance and enforcement blitz across the country in terms of RDISA's operations. We announced at the time our investigations would continue in December of 2015, and the full performance review, which in fact was the midterm review of operations, took the major part of commencing in February 2016. And due to lack of cooperation, it took a long time to get a full report. In fact, we're bringing some boxes here to show what we've done on the litigation. In terms of the audit performance review, there's bucky loads of documents that we had to provide in terms of that audit. So that we have shared. So I just want to give an undertaking that in terms of that evidence, documentation, reports, they were often delayed, they did not come, they were vague, they did not answer the department's questions on many aspects. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Sham?
Chair, I think between the Minister, DG, and Mark, they've covered most of the issues. The only thing that I think might was your question about whether there was a report from the liquidators. Yes, Chair, there was. And I think the DG briefly alluded to the report in terms of what they actually discovered in the bank accounts and so forth. And once there is a final liquidation, I think it's Honourable Makubela's question in terms of are we going to attempt to recover the resources. That is part of this process, as the Minister indicated already. The PTI application is precisely to do that. And in addition, once the process around the final liquidation has been finalized, the liquidators will also then be obliged, in terms of the liquidation order, to actually look at the preceding transactions and try and recover as much money as possible. Chair, thank you.
Okay.
Just one question that was not answered. Sorry, Chair, on the small operators. Honourable Makubela, we've done both. We have done some analysis, not in-depth analysis, not on the actual viability, because partly we have an opportunity to then look at what was working best with the RDISA system, because there are things that are good in the operations of RDISA, so that we then enhance those. And those, where are the gaps, and how do we then bring in improvements in those areas of gaps? So one, the question that we're contending with, when we're then starting to really get the information about SMMEs, processors, or transporters, from the operations that we were getting from the liquidators. That was July, August. And in the question was then, what is going to be our basis? That is our discussion we had with Treasury, to exclude others that were currently operating versus choosing some. Okay. So we then said, let them just allow. They said they would allow us the period. At least you can, in some of them where you have glaring clarity that there is a real gap, have 3 months so that you then establish the new grounds of agreement because partly those were things that they reached an agreement with Redisa on. Maybe they were satisfying Redisa's requirements, but they may not be satisfying our actual requirements. So that is why clinically it's better that you then have, you give all of them an opportunity to participate and see whether there could be improvement. But on the main, performance is definitely the base thing. If delivering, if you are a macro collector, you must deliver tires at wherever you are located and to the level at which you are supposed to, and there's a minimum and there's a threshold that they're supposed to then meet. So we will monitor, but also at the same time, that's why in the structure of the Bureau we have what is called business development, partly to actually invest time on then looking at what are the things that can be improved to make sure that those businesses are viable. Secondly, Redisa had, for example, what do you call this grant? They call it an IDG. They were giving operators, microprocessors, a certain amount, but even the people that were exporting, for they would give somebody that export tires, you are exporting a tire to somebody that uses it, either process it and get other products. You give them that and you still pay them. They don't pay you. There's something that doesn't make sense for us there. So we have to invest and investigate exactly what that is. Secondly, even for the cement kilns are the main uptakers currently. But because the depots are filling up, we don't want to create another occupational health hazard. The more they can take, the better. But they were also being paid the same IDG. And remember, there are business people in the operation of a cement kiln that is used as an energy source. Now you are paying somebody that's making a product and making money out of the product. You're giving them free tires. You still pay them a grant. But again, those are matters that we need to negotiate with the cement industry in their participation in this case. So we did not want to be either unfair to others and be fair to others, but we wanted to establish the base for then new negotiations to be undertaken. So that analysis in depth is being undertaken, but at different levels. Thanks.
Is the money sufficient?
No, and yes. The reason why I'm answering like that, Chair, when we were engaging with Treasurer on the allocation, the question that, remember, levies and taxes in government, SARS collects, and there is never really a ring fencing for one department. Okay? We know that even for other, we've heard it with plastic bags and so on. Those funds are not just for the sole reserve of the Department of Environmental Affairs. We still go through the bidding process, through the MINCOMBAT process. However, the basis for our business case was, what has Redisa invested in over the period? Okay, because we're saying these are public funds. And we would have said we want the whole, say we could have received a billion rands, but we would not be able to justify it because we first had to understand what are the current established factories versus what is still to be required. And we were then busy with that business case. Now, in the current situation with the liquidation, if for whatever reason we lose the case, and Redisa has that equipment, okay? If we lose the case, that equipment is not available. We need more investment on the same infrastructure that was invested in previously, okay? If we win the case, and then there is also not liabilities more than, because partly liquidation requires that if there are liabilities, they must sell the assets to probably defray the costs that the creditors are entitled to. However, I think I don't want to talk about minister's strategy in this. There is a strategy that we have in that respect, but we also have that scenario wherein if those are sold, then in essence they are not quite available. So you may still need to reinvest. So our business case was fluid around exactly how much we require. So we have money, but it is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we will then be able to justify exactly how much more when we know, when we've revised the business case on the basis of real scenario, maybe then after the court processes. So currently we will be able to run the operations until the end of the financial year. That from what I've seen on the figures, we will be able to satisfy. As to whether, remember, we're starting only in October up until March. So if it's for the full financial year, we'll probably then require more resources. But again, the questions around exactly what are the operations, where are you investing the money, would then be pertinent at that point. Thanks.
Okay. I see some hands. But I guess probably the last question from my side will be whether... because the intention of this tire program was to divert tires from the landfill sites. So where we are seated currently, I know I've asked this question to Mark, and he said, yeah, but I think we are doing well. So where we are now, are we comfortable? Can we give an assurance that the program is not going to result in a situation? Because the last report we got, we have not received the either annual report of the department, but the last report we received was that almost about 70% of the tires that are manufactured are not going to the landfill site, are going through this program. So do we have something, can we give an assurance that we'll maintain it at 70, it's not going to go down to 50, even less a percentage? For recycling. I see the DG is looking at Mark.
Yeah.
Okay. Mark?
Chair, yes, sir, I can respond in terms of that. We will maintain that, and if not, improve on that. And so I think next year when you come back for the annual report, we'll give you a much better figure in terms of that diversion. And I think safe to say, in terms of the legislation also, tires are not allowed to go to landfill. And so we've given you an update in terms of collections. We don't find them in the environment anymore. I mean, that is the collection rate that of tires that's been collected in the country to date.
Okay.
However, Mark, what you are also... When Minister published the amended tire regulations, we also discovered that the OTR tires were not being diverted.
OTR.
So the big,
big
truck tires, and those the levy has been collected even previously already. So we have a backlog that we need to deal with in that respect. So I'm saying, as much as Mark says, yes, I think we need to then qualify that more. We will be able to come back to then confirm, because there are different categories of tires. We may be doing well with motor vehicle tires, but on others, not quite as well.
Minister?
Chair, your question was about diversion from the landfill sites. Perhaps we should add by saying that was actually not the only or sole target. The additional target was to have recycling also being
done. Recycling.
Yes, so that is a part that we are at serious loggerheads with the register on, because those elements had actually not started yet. Mm-hmm. In our attempts to get this work done, because remember, all along we still believed that, much as there are these challenges, we must do our level best to actually go through the motions, try and help this company as a job creator, much as we have these problems. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, except to say government money must be used for the right purposes. But then when the team, because I asked the team, the GG, that you lead the team personally that goes to these depots to see where manufacturing, what is this thing, processing is happening. And those were actually not, were found wanting. So on that score, we should also say there will be definitely a backlog on the recycling aspect. Just to also indicate that, Chair, there's a reason why we have actually advertised new plant. Remember the laws, the law allows more than one plant that can actually run, including the Bureau itself. So we are considering also allowing other players in any value chain aspect of the operation. Some may come in at adding value, processing areas and so forth, and further collection. So I think through that plan, or an additional plan or plans, or different value chain aspects of these operations, we expect to have some improvements as well and support. And certainly, we do not think that we should continue or allow any exporting that happens, because in some of the instances we get to know that Redisa was actually exporting these tires. In the other words, instead of you getting money and you're hiding the tires by taking them away from you instead of processing them. Well, that was one of the problems that we have had. Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, can we? Can I plead with the members? I see they want to have follow-ups. I thought we were gonna be done at least by 12:30. There's one last more presentation outstanding. I'm going to give Honourable Peden. He's showing me a hand, so it means it's going to be just just a little bit. And I don't know whether Honourable Edwards, you want to come up? Let's give Honourable Peden.
I've got lots of questions because I let Honourable Makubela down here, but I only have a few. Chair, I'm seeing a red light here because this money is going to Treasury, and we're told it's not being ring fenced, which is a red light for me, because if that's going to be allocated as per business plans, and I'm presuming that's environmental affairs business plans, I see a red light. I wasn't entirely happy with the tax things. We were told by the DG that SARS will investigate the tax issues. Does this include the VAT? And we've had a lot of talk on plant and equipment, but not much on the land, because they obviously had to operate from land. And I don't know, and I'd like to know if someone can tell me, can a PBO claim VAT on land purchases? Because if they bought land, there's substantial VAT issues here. Now, a PBO has to register for VAT if a turnover is over 1 million rand. So this VAT issue is concerning for me.
Okay. Who wants to take that?
Thank you, DG. Just to say that, yes, as the DG confirmed, they were a public benefit organization, so they were exempt from income tax, but that would not exempt them from that. At the time of the liquidation, we did ask SARS to also consider whether there was any outstanding VAT issues with Redisa, and they are investigating that. SARS has also indicated that if they considered how the company was structured, KT and Redisa, they were no longer deemed a public benefit organisation, so they might actually owe SARS a lot of money in terms of the Income Tax Act. But the SARS issue has been investigated. The VAT issue of whether there's any outstanding VAT owed on those matters to SARS. Lisa, yes. Yeah.
you want to answer on land, what I understand from the reports, in the main they have been leasing. So it's not most of they have one or two sites that we know under their records. So those are the only it's those facilities that then are also part of the court case because that's owned by Relisa. But in the main, the depots are leased. It's other people that own the land and they have leases. Hence, we had to also run a process of even contracting and leasing for some of the areas where the operations are running. So that is a matter that, again, is covered, but I can't remember now. They have two places that, even including PTI. PTI, they have leased it for 90 years. 30-year lease. They have a 30-year lease there. They don't actually own the land, except the one in Gauteng. That's the one I remember that they own. Thanks.
Okay. So, Minister?
I thought DG was going to deal with ring-fenced money.
Okay.
As well. We have no any other way of looking at this matter because it's now PFMA, not Exchequer Act. Allows no collection, allows Treasury to collect money. And once Treasury has collected money, that's how they allocate it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. That's how the law stands right now. Until we change the law, only then can the money come direct to us. But it's a legal requirement that we have to do that. So, Richard, just to add on this matter, by the way, we actually even found some inconsistencies in these leases, that where ordinary other people who were viewed other way, in some way, land was leased from them, the rates were quite different. Where they were leasing land from some who are very closer to them, the rental was quite high. So those things would also be looked into as and when we redo the continuation of the leases. These documents that are here, can I come back to them just lastly? They do carry that information that we can read as well to just indicate what we've been talking about.
Okay. Well, members have been invited for leisure to go through the documents there.
It's for everybody, but just a set for one set only.
Oh, one set.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I guess a member who wants to get more details can pick up one and go through it over the weekend. And I guess that invitation is there to the members. So we have come to the end of the briefing. It was quite an informative briefing that we have been waiting for eagerly, to understand where are we with the RDISA program. Because, you know, you read about these things in the media, but when the matter is before the courts, we always, as a portfolio committee, try and move away from that until the matters are concluded. Then we can request a briefing. So some aspects were worrying when you read about, and for me what was worrying was the fact that the risks and the possibility existed that this program, which is one of the successful waste this waste stream of tires, which has been one of the success, because we don't have other programs in the other waste stream, so I'm still going to be briefed about that. So my concern was that we shouldn't have this one collapse. But I'm encouraged by the assurances that we've received that there seem to be a seamless transition of taking over from RDISA and Kusasa Taga. and running this this program by the Waste Bureau. And up to so far, the Waste Bureau is managing, and there's capacity that has been reinforced in the Waste Bureau. I think for us, we just have to look at that, receive a briefing. I saw it on our program, this bill that was introduced. We had to prioritize the other one. We had to prioritize the ocean, the marine special planning bill. It involved a lot of work. Members had to travel through the length and breadth of the coastal towns of this country. So it took a bit of a... But I think we are ready just to finalize our deliberation on that one. And then as soon as we are done, I think we should then look at this proposed bill. That will, in effect, sort of give effect to the complete establishment of the Waste Bureau. So we'll do that ourselves. But as soon as the matters are concluded, I guess we'll get a final brief as to what was the outcome of this matter. I guess there are lessons learned out of this experience. And one of the lessons is that going forward, whatever plan that we approve, we must put very stringent measures of accountability into the whole thing. And make sure that if there is no performance, we come in as quick as possible, either suspend or cancel the plan. I think that's one of the lessons that I think could be learned from this episode. But I think the department, we must encourage them to continue, because at the end of the day, the prudent management of the finances of the public is what is important. The money collected by whoever on behalf of government has to be utilized properly. So the department is commended, Minister, for the effort that we have taken to make sure that you put a stop to what is clearly the wrong or the abuse, you know, of money of the people of this country. My only concern is that I know that Redisa used to collect about 600 million per annum, and what has been allocated was 210 from Treasury. I don't know what is the different. The different is what was the abuse of it, or whether was it for other purposes. But I guess you'll continue to do that evaluation. And I guess as soon as the Waste Bureau is established, we can then have a comprehensive sense of what it involves to then manage this this program. So we are done, unless if there's some comments. But generally, as a chair, I've got the privilege to do summary, so which is what I've done. We do have a deputy chair, a claimed deputy chair who's sitting on the other side, who's the shadow of the minister. So I see he's got nothing to say today, so we can then proceed to the next item and get a, maybe we should get a 2 minutes body break, and then when we come back, I've been looking at it, it doesn't look like it's a long presentation, so we should be done. I think by 12:30 we can, 12:30 or 1 the latest, we can be done. All right, let's adjourn and then come back at 12:05. Members are still out. Honorable Peden has asked to be excused, and Honorable Mtun. But I guess we can proceed now. I think we have got an understanding, Minister, that the whoever is presenting will summarize. We've got a on our schedule. We are going to receive a briefing on Operation Pagisa on the chemicals and waste next Tuesday. So more presentation will be shared there, but summary for now. But not we must still do justice to the presentation. Over to you, Honourable Minister.
Thanks, Jim. So the purpose of this presentation is really to provide the background to industry plans, provide the policy and legislative context, and how they evolved over the years in terms of the policy and legislation to what we call now Section 28 Industry Waste Management Plans. With that, I'll take you through some of the aspects relating to the development of plans and the initial policy based documents and relating to the pricing strategy, some aspects around extended producer responsibility, and what has been the progress to date in terms of where we are with the progress on industry plans. Industry plans really provide for the full value chain, what we call ensuring the holistic management of a waste stream. The waste stream can, and the full value chain can include aspects around waste generation, collection, transportation, storage of waste, recycling, processing, and so forth. An industry plan can also include programs for awareness, capacity building, research, development, innovation, and so forth, which are really contents of an industry plan. Also, in terms of the plan, it must stipulate to what extent it promotes diversion, and the issues around recycling of the waste, the targets for job creation and contribution to economic development and so forth. And in terms of your departure point, Chair, I think we take the aspect around lessons learned and how we have to bolster and kind of reinforce the next suite of industry plans, what would be the key criteria and factors. And they include the following. You know, the aspect around the severity and extent of potential impacts of a specific activity on the environment from this particular waste stream, aspects around the availability of resources for regulation of that waste stream, the level of maturity of that particular sector. So you'll find different levels of maturity amongst the 40 or so waste streams we have in South Africa. Packaging, plastic waste, to some extent, we have voluntary programs, so they're kind of more mature. and the same goes for electronic waste and others. So Minister has prioritized those three waste streams, and I'll take you through some detail around that later on. And you get different levels of maturity emerging as we go on in the production and value chain around different waste streams. The next is the level of organization. How is the waste stream organized? How are they arranged in terms of industry associations, networks, and so forth? The level of cooperation and track record of compliance of a particular sector, also a key factor. And of course, existing management measures and controls within that particular waste stream and existing recycling rates. So you have some waste streams that are better organized than others. They have controls, they have targets, they have good voluntary programs and experience, and those are the ones we really targeting. Shall we move on next in terms of the tools and used in the waste sector? And typically here we talk about a cradle-to-cradle holistic management of waste streams, and we have presented previously, you would recall, honorable members, in the waste colloquium that we presented around the circular economy and how the extended producer responsibility works within a circular economy. An extended producer responsibility really talks about post-consumer waste, where we also hold companies responsible not only for production, but the full value chain, even after their product has been used and consumers have used them, what then happens to these products. And they refer a lot to the packaging aspects, but really all products that are produced by manufacturers and producers, are they fully accounted for in the total value chain? And that is really what EPR is all about. Part 7 of the Waste Act provides for details around how industry waste management plans are provided for, and they relate to a description of how they must be submitted, the preparation of plans, and also the compliance and enforcement aspects around them. And it's really Section 28, 29, 30, 31 of the Waste Act. The Waste Management Strategy also that preceded the Waste Act provides for the following: the sound waste management, and it's the full waste hierarchy of reduce, reuse, recycle, and recover. Aspects surrounding the empowerment of previously disadvantaged individuals, job creation and small, medium, micro enterprise development, as well as information management, reporting, statistics, and so forth, which is also quite important. So moving on, Part 7 then provides for various aspects of how industry waste management plans must be provided for, its approval, and it provides for the description of the following: the process for preparation of industry plans, including discussion on responsibility and responsibilities for preparation of such plans, listing the possible contents of such a plan, a description of the consultation processes that's required before approval of a plan, a review of these plans and what the review processes are, as well as aspects surrounding measures that will be taken for non-compliance of such plans. Chair, we then go on to just providing by way of a policy context how the country has evolved over the years to where we are now in terms of what we would call moving forward with the polluter pays principle and mainstreaming that into the formal economy of the country. Way back in 1998, we introduced the National Environmental Management Act. Later on, that in 2000, it was the Integrated Pollution and Waste Management Policy. 2001, we relate to some aspects of the Polokwane Declaration, where waste management was also prioritized there. 2003, the Plastic Bags Regulation came into force. 2004, Treasury announced the Plastic Bag Levy. 2008, the Waste Act came into force. Then we provided within our work with COCTA and the waste collection services functions various standards for basic refuse removal as well as domestic waste collection standards. 2012 was the advent of the waste management strategy, and together at that time we discussed in detail The first industry waste management plan was for tires, and 2014 then provided the Waste Management Act, which amongst others introduced the establishment of a Waste Management Bureau. It included an economic provision by way of a pricing strategy, as well as tightening up on other aspects of regulation within the Waste Management Act. The pricing strategy then provides for the basis around how a polluter waste principle is mainstreamed through industry waste management plans. So as a department, we have two guiding principles. One is the precautionary principle that really covers some of the environmental protection aspects, and the polluter pays principle that then covers the aspect around economic instruments that either incentivize or disincentivize behavior of polluters, behavior of consumers as well. The aim then of the pricing strategy was really to provide a framework for implementation of economic instruments. We'll give you a sense of what those are. Mainstreaming the producer pays principle, using disincentives to reduce generation of waste, increasing diversion of waste away from landfill sites towards reusing, recycling and recovery, and of course supporting economic growth in the region through what we call a secondary resources economy through the beneficiation of waste. The underlying principles is based on a set of what we call waste management charges, and it's really to disincentivize landfilling, disincentivize the so-called throwaway society, and really bring in, you know, valuable recyclables into the value chain, and through that, you know, incur more social benefits, environmental and economic benefits. And it's really looking at how we internalize externalities. So impact on the environment, pollution, and so forth are externalities. By bringing them in, we internalize them and hold producers, consumers responsible in terms of how that waste stream is managed. Then moving on, we give you a sense, Chair, of what these economic instruments are all about. Upstream, you could look at economic instruments by way of how we would tax materials and input taxes, something like how chemicals would be used in certain products. They can be taxed, like certain resins and harmful chemicals. We move on to something like product taxes. You can introduce product taxes, and advanced recycling fees is exactly what the waste tire fee is all about. In the past, we've had deposit refund schemes. They are slowly being reintroduced by the big bottlers like Coca-Cola and so forth. EPR fees is what we'll talk about really in terms of the industry waste management plans. Volumetric fees is something that we are also investigating, and our current work around landfill disposal taxes is also something, some work that we are concluding on in this financial year. At the bottom side, you'll see how those kind of taxes, fees, collection charges, if you want to call them, are used to incentivize recycling on the bottom value chain. So it is a full value circle of what we call a circular economy, how taxes, our incentives are used to manage waste streams better, and at the core of that would be the vehicle that would be used to do that is an industry waste management plan, and the rationale for that is provided extensively in the National Waste Management Strategy of 2012. Moving on, Chair, in terms of how extended product responsibility is managed through the pricing strategy. In the pricing strategy, we provide for two mechanisms. The one on the left, where we call it where an EPR type of fee is managed for an industry, is really the basis for the voluntary programs that's being run in the country at the moment. The collector can program, the waste oil program, and other programs where industry manage themselves. And here we advocate a role for the department and the bureau really through monitoring controls, management of targets and so forth. But the fee itself is managed within the industry. And on the right-hand side is an EPR tech type of model, which we are doing in terms of industry management plans, and which was now legislated from the 1st of February, that the first one being a tire levy would be collected via SARS, and the disbursement and allocation through Treasury and the Bureau directly to what we call product responsibility organizations or industry organizations who have submitted such plans for approval. In terms of the basis for that within the National Waste Management Strategy, it provides for 8 goals. Next slide, please. And in goal 3, you would see, Chair, very specifically a goal to for growth from the waste sector as a contribution to the green economy. It's not showing very clearly there now. I'm not sure what's happening in the computer. But really showing that the National Waste Management Strategy really emphasize the aspect around
computer.
Is it the computer?
Please.
Yeah, let's move
okay.
to the next slide then. So the progress to date is really that the Waste Act provides for Section 28 detailed provisions of how industry waste management plans need to be developed and prepared and submitted for the to the Minister for approval. And these notices were advertised last year and the beginning of this year, and we have to follow a process around the administrative justice in terms of notification, consultation, preparation, submission, and there's a whole lot of time frames that's provided for in terms of how they must be prepared and submitted to the department. The next slide, again, it provides for those options around how the pricing strategy together with those models, those two EPR models, must be managed. And there we've gone through extensive discussions with Treasury and industry associations to explain exactly how that works and the awareness around that. And here, too, Chair, we have to get industry to really start aligning to government's vision of how we want to move forward with these industry plans. At the time, we had to obtain concurrence from the Minister of Finance on the pricing strategy, and we have the, that approval in terms of those modalities for the funding mechanisms and collections of levies and so forth. The functions of the Waste Management Bureau are really detailed in the Waste Act, and it really it's about oversight of industry plans, the disbursement of funding, and the monitoring of the implementation of those approved plans. Where we are to date, Chair, is that the draft notices were published. There was extensive submissions made. We had to go through that very carefully and provide comments to the various industry role players and stakeholders and interested and affected parties that made submissions, and we have subsequently made amendments to those notices, and we are in the process of publishing the final notices calling for those plans. During the time, there was extensive consultations with various industry sectors. Sometimes, you know, we don't know whether industry is kind of delaying us on certain aspects around approving these plans. And so when they raise concerns and issues, we have to address them, and there's been a lot of workshops around that. Further to that, these plans and the provisions of these plans for these plans have been extensively workshop discussed during the recent PAKISA in July and August, and we had a special, two specific, in fact, laboratories, as we call them, dealing with industry plans. It was the waste minimization workstream as well as the municipal workstream working and bringing out ideas and what we call 3-feet plans for these industry initiatives and what we call them now as PAKISA initiatives. And Chair, we'll provide details around those initiatives, which include the Section 28 plans, on Tuesday next week. And just to conclude, in the last slide, Chair, then, is that the final Section 28 notice calling for these plans and the prioritized plans being packaging, electronic waste and lighting waste will be published for implementation within the current financial year. In terms of this notice, industry is required to prepare and submit plans for consideration and approval. Those specific industries, the department will then review, evaluate and assess the plans and then make a submission to the minister for approval for such plans. The work that goes together and running parallel to that will be the different schedules that's required to be published by SARS for the relevant industry plans in the same way that SARS published schedules for the tire plan. With that, I thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much for the presentation. Questions? So the plan that is being looked at, packaging and e-waste and light, only those two. Yeah. Okay. Okay, that's that. Any comment? Okay, Honorable Makubele and Honorable Edwards.
Chair, mine will be on slide 11. Just to find out if on those two scenarios, will they exist at the same time, or we have to choose one? And if that is the case, which one has been preferred? Thanks.
Hello, Edward.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. This might sound funny, but what will this plan do that industry would do different to what industry is doing at the moment? Mark, you spoke specifically about like recycling and that, like in that line. And then when it comes to the tax, I spoke to someone from Plastics SA, and they're a bit worried because according to them, about 55.7% of paper and packaging are already voluntarily collected by industry for recycling. So if this is true, my concern is that if you put a tax onto that on top of that, it means people are paying to voluntarily remove, etc., plus the tax. Just explain to me how that will work, because I mean, it's costing them money already. And then also, when it comes to the Waste Bureau and the plan, the waste management plan, would you consider something like a dual system? For example, the bureau or the plan monitors, whereas industry delivers, like a proper integrated dual system. I don't know if it makes sense what I'm asking. Okay, and then last one, when we go back to the RDSA issue, the plan, I'm not going to the issue, I'm going to the plan. Minister said that we learned a lot of lessons. So what are you going to take from those lessons that we've learned? Because that was the first one, that was like a, you know, the stat, yes, that one. What are you doing with the next one? What are you doing differently? What have you learned, basically? Okay, thanks.
Okay, during our waste management colloquium, we requested Treasury to come and present on the levies. They did not pitch up. we were supposed to follow up with them. But we'll still call them to come and give us that information. Because as the DG was saying, the system currently is that SARS collect into a big basket. So nothing is ring-fenced, and there is a plastic levy that was introduced. And from where we are now, we were not having, and we still don't have the information as to how much money has been collected by SARS on that levy. But what is important is what are we using? What is it that currently we are employing to access that money and to utilize it for the purpose for which it was intended? So I guess part of the industry waste plan on packaging will then talk to issues like that. But I've got a big problem with plastic in particular. I mean, when you drive around, when you walk around, it's plastic littered all over the place. And I raised the point during the colloquium, and I just want to find out whether can't we just for once just get rid of plastic. I know there's a strong lobby there of Plastic South Africa, but can't we just ban plastic and have other methods of packaging other than plastic, because it's a problem. And I know that even in the ocean space, plastic is one of the biggest concerns in that space. So. Somebody's going to comment. Deputy. Okay. Honorable Khadef.
Chairperson, you have just raised a very valid point about plastic. I read one day that some of the producers of this plastic, they put carbon, what they call calcium carbonate, as a filler on the mixture of producing plastic, which is not biodegradable, which does not degrade when it takes time to degrade. So it's a quite a big concern for me, Chairperson, and it really is a big issue. That's why I wanted to comment on that. Do we have capacity to ensure that the plastic that is produced meets the standards that are set by the department or by the country? Because that's the other issue, that we have this plastic end up in the ocean. Do we have capacity? That will be my question, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay. Mark wants to start.
Thanks, Chair. Just to take Honorable Marcabella's question first around the models. Honorable Marcabella, those two models can coexist. So what you have currently is that on the right-hand side, or the left-hand side, is the voluntary program. Some of them exist. So the collector can, the Rose Foundation, waste oil, some of the plastic recycling is in the context of the left-hand side model. What we are promoting now is the industry waste management plan through taxes that will be passed through law, levied, and they would be in the right-hand side. So for those three prioritized waste streams, we would be going the right-hand side route. And at the same time, you will have voluntary programs like waste oil and all that still carrying on. Until such time, we would prioritize other matured and problematic waste streams to also go the way of a levy or a tax. Honorable Edwards, in terms of what would be different, and I think here we go back to some of the aspects around the objectives of the industry plans, and it's slide number 5. It really talks to the full hierarchy of the waste stream. Is it being properly addressed? Aspects around the empowerment of previously disadvantaged individuals and the transformation of the sector, full job creation and SME development, as well as information and statistics and so forth relating to those particular waste streams. Now, I think in a lot of cases, they're not fully inclusive. And when we talk inclusive growth, you know, we talk about, for instance, the aspect around waste pickers on site. And yes, you know, some of the companies may be saying, you know, how much is the collection rate. But Minister will also tell you some stories about how some of those companies will not be able to carry on with the business if it was not for waste pickers themselves bringing that waste to the actual factory that would recycle and put them back into new products. Now, the aspect around waste pickers themselves, their dignity, their issues, their protection, their organization and all of that needs to be better addressed. We have almost 400,000 of them in the country. They are working under very difficult conditions and bad conditions, and the industry must also have a way of including them into the plans, not only as waste pickers, but eventually to become owners, to become, you know, organize them as co-ops or as SMMEs, but also in terms of our Black Industrialist program, that we have to come to a point where the scale-up on recycling becomes more inclusive. Then we have also this notion of what we call free riders. So in industry, you would have those companies that comply and others that would ride on the back of those that are complying and they themselves do not comply. So industry has also asked us, and that is why many of them support the notion of a tax and a government-controlled plan where their own association members are obliged to belong to the plan, and that's exactly what the notice and the new plans call for, that everyone, every producer participating in that particular sector will be required to belong to the plan, will be required to submit reports and so forth. And the aspect of like what Chair is raising, while we have, for instance, 55.7% of plastic being collected and industry say how good they are, they still see some plastic lying around. So we're putting more pressure on those industries. It's their plastic bags, it's their plastic products, and extended producer responsibility makes them accountable to pull all of those things back into the value chain. So while industry has been doing some things, we think there's much more that can be done. And your third point, Honourable Member, is in terms of the functions of the Bureau versus some of the functions of how these industry plans can work. And you're quite right, and that's exactly what we presented, that the Bureau's role is for oversight, is monitoring the implementation of those plans. The actual implementation will be done by the industry, but the Bureau provides, together with other institutions like Treasury, SARS, and other oversights, through the PFMA, that there would be the oversight function. And in the chapter relating to the functions of the Waste Bureau, it's very, very detailed, the functions of the Bureau in terms of the monitoring and oversight controls. And I think in terms of lessons learned, what we would be doing going forward is, and this is how we've organized the new notices around the plans, that we're asking for detailed strategy for implementation, detailed budget and business plans, clear timelines, targets and deliverables, clear definition of such targets, terms and processes, aspects around exclusions, inclusions. So people like Rodisa don't give us a runaround, you know, and aspects relating to what we call the Memorandum of Incorporation, compliance with the Companies Act, compliance with the Competitions Act and so forth, aspects around conflict of interest that to be declared up front, management and governance around controls of the board, directorships, giving details of bank accounts and so forth, property details, all of that, and composition of the board members. And, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons now, you know, from the last plan, as well as, you know, aspects around reporting, auditing controls, performance management, performance reports, detailed monthly reports, and of course the aspects relating to review and amendments of the plan. And those types of monitoring, controls and oversight, I think, would be really tightened up. And we've done that now in how we've written the notices for the new plans. And I think, Chair, on your point around the litter and the possible banning of plastic, there's been different sectors of society asking for different things. Some, you know, would support a ban totally on plastic. So we would ask, you know, what is the ban on? Is it on plastic bags or is it plastic in general? Now, our companies like Sasol, who provides the main polymer and resins for plastics, it's actually two companies in South Africa that do that. They would argue that there's a role for plastic in society and other forms of plastic besides plastic bags.
I didn't know about Sasol.
Yeah, so the main plastic, which is polyethylene, you get four different types of plastics. The main plastic polymer is made by Sasol. Another company called BASF that does the resin and fibers. So the plastic bottles that we see is actually not plastic, it's a fiber. And it's a plastic fiber made by BASF. It's a resin that's 100% recyclable. You can recycle the bottle thousands of times with the same material and it'll still work. So there's been some studies overseas that we've been looking at where other countries tried to ban plastic bottles, for instance, and they failed. Plastic bags itself, yeah. So, Chair, we are busy with a study this year where we're looking at all kinds of policy options relating to the future of plastic bags. And Honourable Khadeba also hit the nail on the head there in terms of some of the non-compliance of some of our retailers around what they're using illegally in terms of fillers. They make them less recyclable than the other bags. And the controls and enforcement of that was supposed to have been undertaken by the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications. It's the NRCS and the DTI. We are busy with extensive discussions with them on how they have to tighten up and bolster their capacity for better enforcement of those bags. And we, in fact, pay them on an annual basis for managing that compliance and enforcement. And so the inspectors that do that, actually inspectors from NRCS and DTI that go to the different facilities that manufacture these bags, there's been some enforcement measures that's been taken against some of the non-complying ones. But we are still tightening up on this, Chair, in terms of together with the study that we're doing around how that plastic regulations has to be revised going forward to really meet the objectives that was initially intended in 2002 when those regulations were promulgated. So I think it's time now for us to have a kind of revisiting of those in terms of how we have to tighten up and improve that particular regulation. I think Honourable Purden, I'm going to ask maybe TG or Isham to talk about the tax issues and the ring fencing aspects. Thanks, Jack.
So you delegate up to the DG.
Chair,
okay,
actually, I was talking on another point with Minister. The question by Honorable Khadebe on the issue of the capacity, I think the way to answer the state will always have to have a room to improve on the capacity because the standard bodies that are set up have the responsibility to make sure that the industry, once there is a regulated, whether it's a thickness or what are the inputs in a production cycle of a product, those are adhered to. So the plastic, the composition of what makes up the plastics is what is making the plastic not to be recyclable and not to have an economic value, per se. So this is an area where I think the minister is also navigating the role of the Department of Environmental Affairs as a regulator versus the role of DTI as a regulator. Because right now, we were in the study that Mark was talking about, and the chief director responsible, they've done the assessment on whether, because plastic before was completely in the country, the plastic bag now, not, because in plastic, as you saw in during the colloquium, it's not just the plastic bag, there are also other plastic products. And plastic bag is just one small part of it, but it's so visible in terms of litter, and it is a problem that we thought could help us manage and help change behaviors. And initially, those plastic bags that we used to have prior to 2003 were completely non-recyclable. And we then, in the plastic bag regulation, we're then introducing the transition of the thickness of the plastic that would enable recyclability. But that was not an end in itself. We needed to even continue to have the improvement. So it does look like, even with the standard that we've set in our regulation, and with all the funds, partly from the money that we receive from Treasury, which we give, we transfer to the agency of DTI, we are not getting the value that we would want to realize. And until a point where I think the minister, like now, if you are going to be able to take over the regulatory function of the what PTI that has been invested upon by Redisa, the question is where that would be, because the regulated function is DR and DTI. So we may have to just make a decision that as part of our enforcement functions, we would have to partly start dealing with these areas. But again, environmental affairs, we are more prone to cooperative governance and try and work with others, which is what we've done with the one environment system with on mining areas. Maybe we need something else in this respect. And I think when you get the presentation from the chemicals and waste next week on the waste economy, you will also realize that there are proposals around certain governance arrangements that we should put in place to improve the capacity of the state in decision-making processes, but also in respect of compliance and enforcement. So it's an area that I think, yes, we have certain gaps currently, and we don't have full control of the compliance function because it is undertaken by another department until we then decide that partly we would have to play that role as a department resources permitting. Chair, on the levy, again, currently I don't remember now, we did a reconciliation at some point on how much the levy on plastics is per annum. How much? Per annum. So there are figures that we know, but as to how much the department gets as an allocation from that is a different matter. So we can get that those figures from Treasury and then present them, but I think it's still correct for the committee to get Treasury to come and make the presentation here.
No, if you are able to help us, it's fine. I think we'll appreciate that assistance.
We can just provide the information, and how they make decisions is another process which the minister is more familiar with, because partly, as we said, they are not, any of these taxes are not requested. So it's not only the environmental levies; there are others also from other sectors. So yeah, but they can give you how much, it should be in the statement of accounts how much is being collected per annum, and that we can make available. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, Mark commented on the possible ban of plastic. plastic bag. Okay, Honourable Minister.
Rwanda is very successful.
Hmm.
Have they banned plastic production? No. They haven't. It's really how it's managed, which is, if you recall, colleagues, honorable members, during the time just immediately after the, what did Falimusa do? Banning, it's not quite banning, it's a prohibition of littering and so forth of the plastic bags. Immediately thereafter, there was a great improvement. What we used to call the flower of our country, along fences and everywhere, decided, I mean, dropped down drastically. This is like a habitual issue, that people then began being charged for the use of plastic when you go to ShopRite, when you go to whatever. And even as people started paying, there came a time when they got used to pay. And then they started to, again, go back to throwing, paying for plastic. Even today, you get asked when you are at a shop, should we give you plastic? Do you want it? And the immediate question always is, yes, I want it. When, in fact, you have a choice of not taking it. So it's also got to do with a societal issue. Just like Rwanda, when you get to the airport, if your suitcase is covered in plastic, they make you leave the plastic at the airport. So I think we really need to just introduce the societal behavior and behavioral change more than anything. The industry itself complained at the time, if it's about littering at this plastic, that they are likely to actually lose a lot of jobs if you have manufacturing and manufacturers being cut down or banning is happening. And this is the reason why Rwanda itself did not ban. So managing it and working with the industry is something that we've got to do meticulously than right now, even in terms of what product does come into the production, these carbon issues and so forth. As a matter of fact, Chair, we will also probably next week just touch on a bit maybe of an example of some of the those who are voluntarily doing this work. What is this company that we're launching, two of the companies, three? Impact has now opened a third big factory. They are renovating the Eastern Cape one for 700 million or so rand. They are running short of cottage cartons already. It's this milk cartons, juices, and so forth. That's the amount, the extent to which they are actually compliant and collecting and so forth. As a voluntary this thing, they are using the micro collectors. To what an extent are they treating the micro collectors in a better way is another big question. And this is the reason why we think that even in that area, in that space, we've got to somehow provide some kind of guidelines as to how you deal with the micro collectors at a municipal level, bring them board on board in the space of management of municipalities, so that they are not out there. They have a protection. They have their everything else. They are regulated. They themselves have an association, by the way, a national association where they have organized themselves. So those are kinds of things that working with them and working with the entire society, I think we can actually improve. I think you can imagine if we're saying tomorrow, not what Rwanda did as a small country with small population than us, let's ban this. This is what the industry has always been warning, that we shall close down. But we settled to a size of the thickness of a plastic bag that's recyclable. Society looked away and voted with their feet. They still throw away, which is very, very bad. And therefore, it calls for education, strengthening our education system, our cultural behavior, and so forth. This is why we even have discussions with the education department. We have something that we've got to share with you. What is this thing? Funda program. that we start with the young learners at the schools and so forth. So we can go on and on, Chair. I'm sorry that I went to elaborate, but I was just trying to say that this is a bit of a complex matter, just and saying let's spend right now. It has happened in our country before. It's gotten back to where it shouldn't really be. Right.
Okay, I think we are done. They're collecting the figures, but I guess we can always get that information later. That is collected. That which we get back, that which the deer get back?
No, no. Mm-hmm. So remember, in the plastic bag price, there is an amount that goes to industry. The industry now, remember, that was partly with, I mean, with the former minister, was to then ameliorate, what is it, to limit job losses and what the investment that the industry had to make to change their production system. Because when you want to change how you make the product, it also calls on you checking on both your processes that you use to actually make that product. So in fact, the analysis should not be done just on one side of government. The industry is also making money now. Chances are,
yeah,
they have initial cost of investment will have long covered. So now this is just money that's coming in.
Yeah.
So it does call for a review, a proper review process. I think that's what we were also reflecting on during the waste Pakisa.
Okay. All right. But in short, Minister.
No, before you summarize, it's on another matter because I would like to come back after you have. It's not desirable. Just that we would like, honorable members, to know that this is actually Marine Week. It starts the 9th, isn't it? And we have visitors in South Africa from IORA, the ministers and teams of those countries that are members of IORA, Indian Ocean Rim Association, who are coming to South Africa. South Africa will be taking over chairpersonship of IORA. But we thought that as DIA, because we are part of the team of IORA, what we are contributing to the IORA chapter of South Africa is, and would like to see this as part of our legacy, is to avail our vessel. But this is work that we're going to be doing anyway. Since 1961, there has not been an expedition to the Indian Ocean to understand more about and learn what is in that ocean. So there's very little known about the Indian Ocean itself. So the expedition team will consist of scientists from South Africa and from the continent. We have called upon members, not just IORA, but members of the continent to come on board and become part of the expedition. It's a second after 1961, since the formation of the UN system in particular. So it's got very prominent history. And this is what we are going to, what, how long is it going to take, about 3 years? So the vessel of Miriam Makeba, SA Agalas 2, is going to be filling up scientists from here. They are leaving on Sunday. We are asking honorable members, those who may have time, just to bid them farewell, but we are going to try and do some farewell issue for them here. They will then leave and arrive in Durban. Those who may do Durban, also welcome there. On Monday, it's arriving on Monday evening there. So Tuesday, there's another activity where the IORA chapter and our provincial and national persons who would be available would also be bidding them farewell. There they shall be joined by the other African states. So the South African ones are going to be leaving here with a few of other international ones, and then when they are there, Durban when they leave finally. They're going to go for 3 weeks on that this excursion and expedition, because they've got to bring more information for us as a country for data banking and understanding our oceans better. Thank you.
Okay. All right, that's valuable information. Guess once details are obtained, the members can, those who are around, can go and do the goodbyes.
10 o'clock chair tomorrow morning.
10 o'clock.
Or here.
Oh, okay.
At the waterfront.
Okay.
And those who are for Tuesday will spend time.
Yeah. I guess members who are around can always liaise through the committee secretary. Who wants to attend there. Since 1961, the next biggest expedition of scientists, I'm sure it's quite an interesting development for the scientific community. Of, they must be very excited. Okay, no, that's a good thing. Thank you very much. honorable members, thank you very much. We are done. Honorable Minister, DG, and the team. Thank you very much for coming, and the meeting, unless if there's a... anything, the program was agreed upon, Honorable Nyambi, last week. Yeah, we know that you attend both minerals and this one. Last week we did approve. There is a slight adjustment regarding next week's meeting, where we are going to receive a presentation on operation Pakisa on the chemical and waste. But otherwise, thank you very much for coming. The meeting is adjourned. Okay, I'm told there is lunch organized down at the restaurant downstairs, so we can just go.